One in four individuals who have autism identify as LGBTQIA.
Wow.
So the intersection of all of this is very real, and it really does matter, and we really do need to pay attention to everyone we interact with.
Hello, I'm Cassie Gillespie, and you're listening to The Social Work Lens, a podcast produced by the University of Vermont's Child Welfare Training Partnership and the State of Vermont. Today, we are beginning a brand new series with licensed clinical social worker Kelly Smith on the triple intersection of trauma, neurodiversity, and gender diversity. This will be a multi-part series, and today we'll begin by exploring what we actually mean by triple intersection. So Kelly, welcome to the podcast. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you, Cassie. I'm glad to be here.
Would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
Absolutely. So as Cassie mentioned, my name's Kelly Smith and my pronouns are she, her, hers. And I live in Hopkinton, New Hampshire and work in New Hampshire. I specialize in the areas of attachment, trauma, loss, and grief. And I would say not only do I specialize in it, but it really has become my passion over the last 35 years. In particular, this triple intersection of trauma, gender identity, and neurodiversity. So I'm excited to be here today. Thank you.
That's so cool. I think we should tell them how we met, maybe, because I, as a social worker, I'm sometimes at various conferences. And these days, I find myself at conferences really just kind of keeping an eye out for anyone who's doing something interesting that might make a really great story to share. And I ended up in a workshop that Kelly was leading and immediately decided we needed to bring her and her program's information to the Social Work Lens. So we made it happen.
We did. and I'll say more about that. So I love Brené Brown and always use a quote of Brené Brown. And Cassie also loves Brené Brown. So when she heard me use Brené Brown, she's like, oh, this is definitely a deal.
This is perfect.
So I will share some Brené with us today.
Okay. It's a little teaser there.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's delve in. So where should we start when we're talking about this?
Well, I think the first thing I'd like to say is I'm really going to ask us all to lean into any discomfort that you may experience as you're listening to this today. I really want you to notice and explore that discomfort because our trans and our non-binary and our neurodivergent youth really deserve and they need us to learn from our discomfort and embrace inclusivity because they live every single day in the world with discomfort. And I like to think about inclusivity through this lens of it's about a person feeling like they matter. And today, probably every day, but today in our society, it's so important that that all of us feel like we matter. So I think that's important to start with. And if it's okay, I'm just going to go to Brené Brown because you can't do anything without quoting Brené. And, you know, I started using Brené, reading Brené and following her and using her quotes in my trainings, particularly around trauma and vulnerability, because that's her area of specialty. And then when I moved into this world of neurodiversity and gender identity, I'm like, oh my goodness, Brené was speaking to that group too. So the quote that I use all the time now, so Brené, thank you for this quote. Love and belonging are the needs of all adults and children. We are hardwired for connection. It's what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. The absence of love, belonging, and connection always leads to suffering. So I think of our individuals who are neurodivergent. I think of our trans, our non-binary. I think of our kids in foster care, all of us and every single one of us. You know, when there's the absence of love and belonging and connection, there really is suffering.
It's such an important place to start. And as I'm listening to you, I'm wondering if it makes sense to, I think lots of folks listening will be familiar with these various terms, but in case some folks are new, would you mind defining what we mean by neurodiversity and gender diversity and even trauma to a certain extent?
Yes, absolutely. And there are definitions that I use in training, but it's really important to know that language matters, but really what matters more is the meaning behind it or that you're attempting, or inclusivity matters because everyone's language is different. So there's first person language and third person language, and people are very passionate about how they identify. And it really isn't up to us to master the language. What's more important is we say who we are and then be curious who that other person is and what language they use. But let me give you some definitions of language, but please hear that everyone defines this in their own way. So really, neurodiversity is the range of diversity that exists in human neurodevelopment, which is so awesome because the way my brain functions is different than Cassie's, it's different than Joey's and Mary's, and it really then gives us opportunity for all of us being different and our brains being different. And the perfect example I give is I have this thing called mesophonia, which is funny, Cassie, because it's going to play itself out a little bit in our time this morning. So mesophonia is when I overhear things. It's like microphones on every little thing that Cassie's doing across the studio right now.
Which is pouring more coffee in my mug, in case you're wondering.
I can sit in a movie theater and somebody can be eating some popcorn from up in the front row. And I look at my spouse with these evil eyes like, if they eat one more piece of popcorn, I'm taking them down. So how my brain processes sounds is different than how other people process sounds and experiences and language and processing and everything.
Yeah,
So then neurotypical, and I don't think we really have neurotypical anymore because we really are embracing this neurodiversity.
Yeah.
But neurotypical really is a person or people whose neurodevelopment falls within this kind of typical development. Neurodivergent is a person or people whose neurodevelopment falls outside of what's considered typical. And neurodiverse, then, is the collection of terms for groups, including people who are neurodiverse and neurotypical. But I think where I land is we all just are neurodiverse.
Yeah.
So that's where I land.
But the world tends to be built in these ways to expect people to function in quote-unquote neurotypical ways,
Absolutely. And our society and movie theaters and classrooms and gymnasiums and really most of the things are set up for this neurotypical world. And I know just in the last couple years and specializing in this a little bit more, I've become more and more aware of how my brain processes is different than my spouse or my kid or anybody else. So it really is quite freeing. And I believe that's where we're moving to. And that's where I want us to move to.
And if we're thinking about the way these terms are kind of used in common parlance, I feel like there's a collection of diagnoses or ways that you hear the term neurodiverse used or neurodivergent used either in the school system or in the mental health system. What are some of the diagnoses that people might carry who are kind of grouped under that umbrella term?
Autism would definitely be one of them. ADHD could be one. Anxiety, definitely sensory integration disorder. And I will talk a lot more about sensory as we talk more about the specifics of neurodiversity. So I would say those are our major diagnoses.
And that, you know, diagnoses in of themselves are kind of a complicated idea, but I just wanted to make sure we're painting the picture, connecting some dots for you listening. If you've heard some of those terms and not been clear about how they connect to each other. So how then do you think about gender diversity?
Yeah. Boy, there's a lot of opinions right now about gender diversity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wish it could go back to just inclusivity again, that we all matter. So gender identity is how I experience my gender identity. How do I experience that in my brain? So really, in the core of who I am, do I identify more masculine, more feminine? And then what happens, though, is it's how do I express that? Mm-hmm. So in my brain, I might experience who I am to my core as a man. But I may choose, and this is where there can be choice. So the identity, there isn't choice.
Mm-hmm.
But where there is choice, and guess what? We all made a choice this morning when we got up and got dressed.
Yeah.
So I made a choice this morning to express my gender as a woman on a snowy day in Vermont.
It is so snowy today.
Snow, so snowy. And I have boots on and a sweatshirt and a pair of pants. I would never dress like this going to work. But that's how I decided to express myself. And tonight, if I get to go out tonight in snowy Vermont, you know, I probably will dress much differently than I am right now. And, you know, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to a funeral. So I absolutely will dress. I probably will have a skirt on and a, you know, and a jacket and a pretty blouse and things like that. So when I wake up in the morning, I know I'm a woman. And then I look at the closet and I look at the weather. I think about what I'm doing today. And then I'm like, this is how I'm going to express myself today.
Yeah.
How I'm going to express my gender today. And I wish that's where folks could maybe understand that better. And we all have gender expression. We all are gender in terms of how we express ourselves. It's fluid based on what our thoughts and feelings are that day. But the identity is not fluid or choice.
Thank you. That's super helpful. All right. So when we think about a triple intersection of trauma, neurodiversity, and gender diversity, I mean, let's just kind of define, like, what does that mean? What is a triple intersection of those three kind of big words that we've been trying to unpack?
Maybe it would be helpful if I also defined trauma, which asked me to before. So there are many definitions of trauma. The framework that I use for thinking about trauma, and I'm a trauma therapist, so I've been thinking about this for 35 years. But the framework that I like to use comes from the National Child Traumatic Stress Network, better known as NTSN. And their definition, or the frame that they use, is a traumatic event is a frightening, dangerous, or violent event that poses a threat to a child's life or bodily integrity. Witnessing a traumatic event that threatens life or physical security of a loved one can also be traumatic. So there's a lot that can fit within and under that definition.
Mm-hmm.
So let's think then about the triple intersection. And I want to talk about just intersecting identities in general first. So Identities run in a linear way. I'll start with that. So I am a social worker. I'm a woman. I am married to a woman. I'm a mom. I love theater. I love travel. So those are some of my identities. I'm getting older. Well, I would call it myself, I'm getting more mature.
Seasoned.
So those are my identities, okay? And they run in this linear way for a moment. But then as soon as I get out of bed. I got out of bed this morning and I was a woman and I was a social worker because I know I was coming here to meet with Cassie and Joe. And as soon as I took a breath and got ready, my identity started overlapping because I was a woman, I was a social worker, I was dressing for the snow, I live in New England, my back hurt a little bit because I'm older and I wasn't in my bed. So all of my identities immediately started interacting with one another. So that's important for us to think about. And as you're listening to this, I really have fun with this. You know, do this at a dinner party. Do this while you're driving to work. What are your identities? And then we start to think about how do they intersect with one another? Because they do. Immediately they start intersecting with one another. And what we know about intersecting identities, and I really recommend Dr. Webster or Kimberly Crenshaw's work on intersectional identities. What happens is I can start to overemphasize and make assumptions about people who maybe look like me, share a same gender, are social workers, are white, female. So I can make some assumptions about those people because it appears that we share the same identities.
Like you think you know something about them because you know something about how that works for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is I make assumptions that are wrong. And I make assumptions that my way of doing it's the right way of doing it. And what is more helpful to do is to know what my identities are and then be curious with someone else about their identities and how do they intersect versus making assumptions. So we may know one person with autism. We may know one person who's white, who's a male, who's 16 with autism, but then we only know that one person.
Right.
And we can't make assumptions. So that's what I want to say about intersecting identities is figure out what yours are and then be curious and open to learning what others are. And the other piece about it is that when we are stressed, so let's say I know what my identities are and I go into a situation where someone else has completely different identities than I do, what can happen is my brain becomes stressed and then I can choose to not engage because I'm making assumptions about those other people have nothing in common with me or I'm uncomfortable with those people. So it does both things. It makes me make assumptions and it also stops me from being curious and getting to know other people.
And that goes back to what we said at the beginning, that love and connection and belonging is so important. And if we're leaning in or not leaning in or guarding ourselves because we've already decided that we don't have it with someone else, we really lose that opportunity to see people as human, right?
Absolutely.
Awesome. I mean, not awesome, but powerful.
So some folks may be listening and say, well, you know, why does this matter? I know one person with autism. You know, why are we spending all this time? And I know one gay person. Ooh, I know it all. No, the numbers really do tell the story. And the numbers also underestimate because numbers are based on stats, which are based on information we have, which is based on information we've received. So here are some numbers for us to really know that all of this matters. So 9 in 1,000 children are maltreated in the U.S. annually. So those are the ones with open abuse and neglect cases.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that there's more than that, but 9 in 1,000, that's a lot. 1 in 44 youth have an intellectual disability. 1 in 36 children are diagnosed with autism. And 1.6 million youth age 13 plus identify as transgender. And 1 in 4 individuals who have autism identify as LGBTQIA.
Wow.
So the intersection of all of this is very real, and it really does matter, and we really do need to pay attention to everyone we interact with.
All right, well, that's so powerful. So one of the questions I have and was really excited to hear more from you about is how we should be thinking about kiddos' experience with trauma when we're talking specifically about these populations.
It's a big question. Thanks for asking it and really thinking, allowing us to think about it. So I think it's important because these youth are so marginalized and walking through their world at school or home or their neighborhoods, their sports teams, there are so many opportunities for them to not be understood or worse, which would be traumatized. So our youth are traumatized in so many different ways. And so I think we need to make the assumption that there is trauma that these kids have experienced and still do experience. And the types of trauma that a kid with neurodiversity might experience is bullying, being excluded, cut off relationships and isolated. They're not often invited to school dances. They often struggle playing on school teams, football teams, and I'll talk a little bit more about that from a sensory perspective. Transitions and changes are really hard. And a lot of these traumatic experiences or events happen as a result of a neurological sensory experience and how they experience the world differently than other kids. So there's something called sensory integration disorder, and it really is a part of neurodiversity and autism. And what that means is that our kids, and all of us, but our kids experience sensory experiences in different ways. So bright lights can be too bright, and noises can be too loud, and textures can feel like sandpaper. So if you think of a kid at school who's expected to go to the lunchroom at 11:10, and the lunchroom's a loud place, that can be an absolutely overwhelming experience for them.
Mm-hmm.
And the example I have is, so I have a nephew who's 26 with autism. And again, that's a language issue. So what he likes to be called is, he is my nephew with autism versus he is autistic. So that's a perfect example of how language matters to him. So my nephew's 26 and has autism, and he has high levels of support need. In the old days, even 2 years ago, we called it high functioning, low functioning. That is not correct language anymore. It's the level of support needs that they need. So my nephew needs high level support needs. So he's at school and he's in the lunchroom. And every single day, Cassie, I am not kidding, still today, he eats a cheeseburger with a bun, no sesame seeds. It has to be the right ketchup. And oh my goodness, the school district decided to use a different brand of cheese.
Oh.
I know. Oh, wow. You know it was for budgetary reasons, right?
Yeah.
No one in the whole world would have known the difference about the cheese on the cheeseburger. But no,
he did.
My nephew did.
Yeah.
He took one bite of it and he lost his noodle because it tasted different to him. And he's saying, it's the wrong cheese. It's the wrong cheese. And he's backing up and he's throwing his thing down because his sensory experience and his neurological sensory makeup was off as a result of that cheese. And then what happened in the rest of his body because of that silly piece of cheese. And it was important for us to listen and really learn from him. What is up, buddy? The cheese, the cheese. So I'm having school meetings over a piece of cheese. And no kidding, principal didn't know what was going on. Sped director didn't know what was going on. Come to find out, they had changed the cheese.
And he knew it.
And he knew it. But if we didn't stop and listen to him, who has high support needs, who doesn't have a lot of language, but we really needed to stop and listen to him in order to figure out what the heck was happening at lunchtime.
Yeah.
Because he was refusing to go to school.
Mm.
And it could have been seen as a behavior.
Right.
And instead, we had to stop and really think about it. And that episode could have led to seclusion, could have led to isolation, could have led to restraint, and a lot of other traumatic experiences that could have happened for him if we wouldn't have stopped and listened.
Yeah. Yeah. That's such a great example. It's really about what's underlying the behavior, right?
Exactly.
And how that makes sense to that individual.
Yep. And, you know, another example for our kids who are neurodivergent, and we don't think about this at all, they have usually a higher number of medical appointments. So it could be the therapist, it could be occupational therapy, it could be they have to go to 3 dentist appointments because it's a difficult sensory experience. So what I can do in one appointment, they need 3 appointments. And they can experience significant traumas from these very routine procedures that maybe Cassie, you and I can do, or our children can do. So my nephew has to have blood drawn every 3 months. And the process of getting him to have blood drawn, you know, our listeners can't even imagine, you can't even think through this, but it's taking the coat off and then putting that rubber band around you and then putting your arm out and then sticking with blood. And then they didn't find the right vein.
Yeah.
And then you take that rubber band off, and that whole 15-minute experience can take us an hour. And then do I send them back to school or do we go out for a soda or a snack to regulate him?
Yeah.
Before I send him back to school. But we've experienced some judgment about, well, it was only a 15-minute lab appointment, and yet you were gone for 3 hours.
Right.
Well, I can send him back to school.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But he's going to end up isolated, excluded, potentially in a sensory room.
Right.
And a lot of other traumatic experiences for him.
That follow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you making that visible to us. Those are really powerful examples about things we might not consider if you sort of have the privilege to move through the world in a neurotypical kind of framework, raising neurotypical kiddos. is there a framework that you suggest when we talk about the, I feel like I've just used the word framework five times, but when we talk about working with neurodiverse or gender diverse kids who have experienced trauma, is there a framework you suggest that can be helpful?
Absolutely. I think a lot of us as clinicians or as educators, we are listening for the behaviors and trying to shift behaviors. And my perspective as a trauma therapist, and now really specializing in these three areas and the intersection of them, I think it's super important for us to understand the behaviors who tell a story. But what we really need to do is we just need to look at these individuals, our individuals. They're all of us. They're our kids. They're our nephews. They're all of us. There's a couple words here that I use to describe. It's important for us to see these individuals as amazing, unique, strong, creative, courageous, funny, resourceful, and they want to be connected. And often you'll hear in the autism world, because they can't make eye contact, they don't want to be connected. Or because they read social cues differently, they don't want to be connected. They don't want to have friends. They're not able to have friends. And it's the opposite of that. They want to be connected in very important ways, but they do it differently. So I need to show up, and we need to show up, instead of seeing them as bad or weird or odd or special or anything like that. It really is, you are amazing and unique and creative and strong and courageous and resourceful, and you want to be connected, and I want to be connected to you. So help me understand how to be connected with you.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really different framework than how we typically see our neurodivergent youth.
Okay. And is that the same, would you say, for the way people tend to engage or not engage with youth who are also expressing gender diversity?
100%. I think I would add with those youth would be they want to be accepted and loved.
Yeah, they need to.
They need to. And we'll talk maybe in a different part of the series around what happens when we don't have acceptance and love with gender identity. So the other thing I want to say about the framework, though, so who are these individuals? You know, I listed off all those words that are important to really to think about. But then it's about how do I show up? Who am I and how do I show up versus how do I change them so they can be successful? It really is how do I need to show up every single day when I'm working with or living with or loving an individual who is neurodivergent.
And that's really changing the status quo, right? Because the world is built in such a way, we want these youth to show up to our neurotypical structures and be functioning. And so you're suggesting a total flip on that.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And we are charged with, I think charged is a good word, but I also think we are given the opportunity and the honor to really look for opportunities to practice and teach and be patient and just be over and over and over again there with them. And it's important for us to be regulated. And I'll talk about that a little bit too. There's so much to talk about. So we'll talk a little bit about the window of tolerance. But it's vital for us to be regulated. We need to engage with the individual. If something happens, we're the ones to need to lead the repair in what happened and reconnect. So let me break those down a little bit for us, Cassie, if that's okay.
Yeah, let's do it.
So we'll take my nephew who is losing his noodle over a piece of cheese, right? And the chairs are going everywhere and he's crying and all this kind of stuff. So what I need to do in that situation is I need to be regulated. And what I mean by regulated is my tone of voice, my heartbeat, my heart rate, how I approach him. I need to just be calm and regulate because he's losing his noodle.
Yeah.
And if I lose my noodle and he's losing his noodle, we're going to have noodles everywhere and it's not going to be pretty. Okay. So I got to stay regulated. And then what happens, and our goal is to help him become regulated. But The way you do that is to engage with him in a low and slow sort of way. I don't scream and say, "What's wrong with you? Pick up those chairs." Instead, I say, "Hey, buddy, what's going on?" Or I say, "Hey, buddy, you're having a tough time. I'm just going to hang out here with you. I'm just going to hang. We're going to figure this out. I'm right here, and we're going to hang out. We're just going to hang out." And what you will see, it's beautiful to see, actually, what you will see by you being regulated and just being in presence of this other individual, you will see their brain become regulated. You'll see their body start to calm down just by your presence of being with them and you being regulated.
It's some beautiful co-regulation.
It is really awesome to be a part of that and to see. So then we're engaged and he's back, you know, he's back regulated. And, you know, I'm not going to ask about the cheese. I'm not going to ask about what happened in the lunchroom. I'm going to say something like, "Buddy, oh my gosh, I noticed you're wearing your purple socks today. Dang it, I don't have my purple socks on, but I'm going to wear mine tomorrow." And then you're going to say, "Hey," he loves the Red Sox. "So, hey, what happened with the Red Sox last night?" So we're just re-engaging with him.
And you've learned what works for him over time, right? Because
Absolutely.
Of his sort of unique who he is as a person. And then you've been able to figure out what is more, I don't know, soothing.
Yeah.
Right?
Because I see him as amazing, unique, strong, resourceful, creative. So yeah. I've learned that about him. And then this is a piece where I think a lot of adults miss it. So the next step in this process is the repair. And often when we think of repair, we're thinking of, oh, he needs to apologize and pick up the chairs and write an apology note and he needs to show respect and he needs to blah, blah, blah. And instead, what happens in this framework is I say to him, "Joey, I am so sorry we've had a tough lunchtime today. That was a bummer for both of us." And by doing that over time and over time, Joey will learn when I say, "This is a tough lunchtime and let's figure this out together." Joey will learn to be able to say, "Miss Kel, yeah, I'm sorry I threw a chair." And that's what you're looking for. And then it's the reconnect. So the repair and then the reconnect. And the reconnect is, "Joey, you pick up the chairs over there. I'll pick up the chairs over here. Let's have a race to see who picks up the most chairs the fastest. Maybe the janitor can even time us to pick up the chairs. Let's get this done so we can go back to art class."
Yeah.
And we just avoided isolation, restraint, seclusion, and a six-hour nightmare by just regulating, engaging, repairing, and reconnecting. And I think the last thing I'll say about kind of the framework and how do we show up is be curious, compassionate, and kind.
You know, one of the things I just want to say about this is the sort of ubiquitousness, is that too big a word? The universal application of this framework to all people, you know? So last series, we were talking about youth suicide and the public health crisis that is youth suicide. But one of the things that our amazing guests kept sort of centering was actually one of the most impactful things that we can all do is be regulated with youth when we come to that conversation. Like, you know, have your own steady breathing, have your own reactions under control, and then just be curious about what's going on for that kiddo and be there, right? It's the same.
Absolutely.
It's this, regulate yourself and then be curious and connected. And, you know, in a separate role that I have, I do organizational consulting. And the amount of repair and reconnect conversations we're coaching workplace leaders to do, I mean, we term it a little differently, right? It's like feedback and conflict resolution, but it's the same conversation. It's the same skill set. So I just really appreciate, as always, that's what's so vital for our most vulnerable folks is also applicable in literally every part of adulting.
Absolutely. Yep.
Thank you for humoring my kind of soapbox rant there.
Well, I think we both have rants, right? Because we're so passionate about this. And so, passion and rants.
Okay, so one of the things we have to do is sort of, or listeners that we try to do, is dose our episodes here, titrate them so that there's good information, but not too long. So we're going to create two more episodes. The next one, we're going to talk about the intersection specifically between trauma and neurodiversity. And then we're going to come back and do a third where we talk more specifically about the intersection of trauma and gender diversity. Kelly, is there anything you want to go a little deeper into or give a little more context on before we wrap this one up?
Absolutely. One thing that I mentioned very briefly that I said I'd get back to, so thank you for the reminder, Cassie. I want to talk a little bit about window of tolerance. I was describing it there in that example, but the window of tolerance is really important for us, and this can save marriages, this can help in parenting, this can help you with you and your in-laws or your boss. So the window of tolerance is this concept of we all have a window where we have the capacity to be frustrated and sad and mad, and but we're still regulated. You know, we're not cussing and screaming. We're not going to bed for 6 hours. We're just regulated. And we're able to modulate those various emotions within a window. But then what happens for all of us, we can go out of the window, and that's where we experience an emotion or a situation and we become dysregulated. So our heart rate will change, our breathing will change, we become really preoccupied with what it is that's upset us. And what happens then is our frontal lobe really kind of shuts down.
Yeah, you get into that fight, flight.
Yeah. Fright. So what we want to do as parents and professionals working with or loving someone who's in the moment dysregulated and out of the window, as I was saying before, we just want to be with them. We just want to sit with them and be with them. And we want to use very little language and we want to go low and slow. And our only goal there, and again, this is cool brain stuff. The only goal is to get that person back in their own individual window of regulation. And you do that by, as I've already said, and as we've already talked about, Cassie, you do that just by being present and helping them become regulated. So I may mention in the future series about window of tolerance, and it's important that you understand what that is.
Yeah, yeah. We have a six-year-old, and we talk about this a lot, and we use the phrase, can I share my calm with you? And depending on how dysregulated everybody is, you know, sometimes it's a yes, and sometimes it's a no! But ultimately, you know, whether we're using those words or not, that's what we're doing, right? We're sharing our calm.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then they're taking it on, and their brain is able to self-regulate, and then their body shifts as a result of that. So it's quite beautiful.
That's awesome. All right. Well, that's probably a really powerful place to leave it. So listeners, be sure to rejoin us for part two and part three to get more from Ms. Kelly Smith. The Social Work Lens is produced by the University of Vermont's Child Welfare Training Partnership and the State of Vermont. Our theme music is composed and performed by local band Brick Drop, and our sound production and engineering has been brought to you by Egan Media Productions. We'd also like to give a special thank you to our in-house administrative production assistant, Emma Baird. For the Social Work Lens, I'm Cassie Gillespie, and we'll see you next time.